Hello, and welcome to the Merry Menopause Book Club, the podcast that brings you the authors of the books written to inspire us, educate us, and guide us on our journey through midlife. Created and hosted by me, Jo Fuller, menopause and menstruation educator and founder of the Merry Menopause. I want to give women the information and education they need to make empowered choices around their health and well-being so that ultimately they can have a merry menopause. Hi and welcome to this episode of the Merry Menopause Book Club podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Philippa Kay. She's a GP with a particular interest in children's, women's and sexual health. She has written multiple books on a range of topics from pregnancy and fertility to children's health and development, including today's book choice, The M Word. Philippa has a weekly column in Women magazine and regularly appears on ITV's This Morning. She's the GP ambassador for Joe's Cervical Cancer Trust, and her days are filled with a mix of general practice, media work and her other job being a mum. Philippa, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And it's so lovely to meet you again. We have met before a year ago at the book launch of M Word on a very rainy night in a sex shop in Hackney.
A women's only sex shop, yes. I mean, where else would we start talking about the menopause? Because quite frankly, sex is important. So why not?
Yeah, no, it was a great choice of venue. It was a great choice of venue in Pitfield Street, the shop. Yeah, that's how you pronounce it. So lovely to connect with you again. And thank you once again for giving up your time. I know how busy you are to talk to me. I loved The M Word. It was one of the first menopause books that I was sent and asked to have a look at. And it answered a lot of questions for me when I was just starting out with Merry Menopause. And it really is one to have on the shelf. It's a great sort of almost like menopause Bible. It's got so much information in it. But what I particularly like about it is the area that you focus on, and you actually say in the book that when you were pitching this book and you looked for similar titles and you found a wealth of books of natural solutions to the menopause, but very few on HRT. Yeah. And HRT is still such a controversial subject. It's still a divide between should I or shouldn't I. I'm all about educating women so they can make a choice whether or not they choose to take it. But tell me about HRT. And before you do that, I'll tell you one of the questions that comes up in my Facebook group a lot about HRT is women saying it's not working.
So I think when I went to write the book in the first place, I wrote it because I saw that my patients seemed to need it and that they would come in with lots of symptoms and they only really knew, and this is not their fault, about flushes and sweats being related to the menopause. And when I would ask them about other things, a sort of a whole tirade would come out, a waterfall would come out. And I would always be the one, for example, to bring up sex and libido and whether or not sex hurts. And so it was clear to me that we needed something that could be very empowering and very educational. And then when we started to dig in with those patients, why haven't you come earlier? You know, what's your worry? What's going on? There is this huge fear around HRT. And there are historical reasons for that. And there are social reasons for that, which we can go into. But what I wanted to do was write an evidence-based book so that people know that if they go to this source, that they're getting information that is correct. Because the internet is a wonderful, wonderful place. You just don't know who you're talking to. And you don't know the background and the and the qualifications of the person that you're talking to. And I wanted to write something that I knew that women would be able to pick up and say, right, this is based on the evidence of what is out there. And there are lots of natural things in the book, and there are lots of lifestyle things, and there are lots of changes that you can do. But you can't make choices unless you're informed. And that's why it was so important to me to write it. Now, the weird thing about HRT is that we are a long way from where we were 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago. And the whole sort of furore starts in the 2000s around the Women's Health Study, which seemed to show that there was an increased risk of blood clots and particularly breast cancer on women with HRT. A few years later, in the last few years, the authors of that study did something that scientists very rarely do, which is apologize, because the way that that study was designed and the way that it was reported is not the way that we give HRT anymore. And unfortunately, what's happened is that those headlines of 20 years ago, HRT causes breast cancer, have never gone away in the public memory and are still there in the public memory without necessarily an understanding of A, what we do now, B, what was wrong with that study and how things are different, and C, that everything in life is a balance of risks versus benefits. And the risks of HRT are actually, for most women, very, very small. And for many people, will be outweighed by those benefits. But you can't make that choice until you know about it.
Well said, very well said. And I love the bit where you say that, you know, that the risks in life, you know, any medication, you take a paracetamol, you put on a plaster, there's a risk of, you know, an adverse effect. So, yeah. And HRT as a formula is very low risk, isn't it, to the majority of women?
Absolutely. So if we go through the risks, because that's what women are concerned about. First of all, that big study was in women who started taking HRT over 10 years past their menopause. Now, we can do that, but most often we don't do that. And in general, we are starting it around the time of the menopause or even in the perimenopause when you've still got periods, but you're symptomatic. So don't worry if you think, well, I've got my periods and I'm still struggling, but there's nothing that can be done. There is absolutely something that can be done. So the first one is breast cancer. That's the one that everybody has heard of. And we have to take it into consideration with what else might be going on. So the background risk for women between the ages of 50 and 59 to develop breast cancer is 23 out of 1,000. That is 23 out of 1,000 women of that age are going to develop breast cancer no matter what. Okay. If you smoke, if you drink more than 14 units a week, that's about a big glass of wine, probably not even a glass of wine a night, then another 4 or so cases per 1,000. If you have obesity, your risk is doubled. It's another 23 or 24 per 1,000. If you take HRT, there's an extra 4 cases per 1,000. 4 per 1,000. That's what, 0.004%? This is not a huge amount. When we have to weigh that up against one, getting your life back as I relieve your symptoms with it. And that is not to be underestimated when your work life, your personal life, your relationships, your social lives are hugely affected by the symptoms that you're having, be that sweats, flushes, joint pains, headache, irritability, mood changes, depression, anxiety, difficulties with memory and concentration. That is a huge pro for HRT. Plus, what it does in the medium term with decreasing the risk of urinary tract infections, making sure that sex isn't painful and avoiding the genitourinary syndrome of the menopause. And then what it does in the long term, decreasing your risk of dementia, decreasing your risk of osteoporosis, which is where your bones become thinner and fragile and you're more prone to fractures. And it's one thing to say, oh, okay, well, osteoporosis is just in bones, but actually the impact of that fracture that it then may have in later life on your mobility, on your ability to function. And actually, HRT can decrease your risk of certain cancers like colorectal cancer. So those are lots of pros. Another thing that people were worried about was blood clots. Now, we've been talking a lot about blood clots recently in the press with the COVID-19 vaccines. And what came out was how many women were not aware that the oral contraceptive pill increases your risk of clot. It's a small amount, but it does. And that's why if you're a smoker, have obesity and are over the age of 35, we're going to give you something else instead. But the risk of clot with HRT is small, but I can get around it by avoiding an oral preparation of estrogen. When you take estrogen orally, it goes into your gastrointestinal system and your liver tries to get rid of most things. Your liver is one of your detoxifiers. So you don't need to buy a detox drink. You've got liver, kidney, skin. It's doing it for you. So your liver tries to get rid of it and your liver is involved in clotting processes. And if you take estrogen orally, there is an increased risk of clot. If I give you estrogen through the skin, be that a cream, a gel, a patch, a spray, you don't have an increased risk. So actually, for many women, the benefits far outweigh the risk. As a rule of thumb, if you're thinking that was a lot of information and I don't know what the answer is, if you are between the ages of 50 and 59, in general, to start HRT, the benefits outweigh the risk. In general, between 60 and 70, the benefits and risks of starting are about the same. And in general, the risks of starting, and remember, I'm saying really quite clearly here, starting HRT over the age of 70, the risks tend to outweigh the benefits. But once you're on it, let's say that you start it at 51, 54, 48, wherever you are, there is no defined stopping point. You need to see your doctor every year to have your blood pressure checked. You should be checking your breasts regularly. But as long as nothing changes and those benefits continue to outweigh the risks, you can keep going and going and going as long as every year you make with your doctor that informed choice. If something changes, if you, for example, are one of those women who develop breast cancer, and remember, 23 out of 1,000 are going to develop breast cancer every year anyway without HRT, then yeah, we're going to take you off it. But as long as the benefit outweighs the risk, you can continue. Just a side note, vaginal estrogen, which is estrogen that you take topically in the vagina, either as a cream or a pessary, is classed, according to the pharmaceutical world, as HRT, because it is a hormone that is being replaced. However, from a medical's point of view and from a risk's point of view, it's not, because it doesn't get absorbed into the blood and it doesn't have an impact on the rest of the body. And actually, using vaginal estrogen, which we would use for painful sex and genitourinary syndrome of the menopause, where things are very dry, sore, itchy, and often associated with urinary tract infections, using that for a whole year is the same as taking one or two tablets of HRT. So those risks are tiny. So even if you have had breast cancer in general, we can give you that. So I would separate that slightly from the other forms of HRT.
Wow.
It's a lot. Sorry.
Do you need a break, Philippa? Have a drink after that. That was amazing. I mean, that's just all in your head. And that's just come out. I mean, that's, yeah, fantastic. So that was a 101 on HRT there in about 3 minutes. Thank you so much. Can you take regular HRT and the vaginal HRT together?
Yeah, so the start, I think that everything in medicine has a treatment ladder. So in the same way, if you came in to me with a headache, I'm not going to give you a shot of morphine. We're going to start with paracetamol, right? And we climb the ladder of pain relief. And we have that kind of ladder of treatment for lots of different things. And one of them would be genitourinary syndrome of the menopause, which often used to be called atrophic vaginitis. And that's whereby the tissues of the vulva, being the external genitals, the vagina being the tube that goes inside, have got very thin due to the lack of estrogen after the menopause. And that can lead to symptoms like itching, burning, soreness, painful sex. And we would start by saying, okay, you need to use good lube. Good lube is every woman's best friend when it comes to sex. Okay. And you need, when I say good lube, I mean something that doesn't have anything that's irritant in it, something that's pH balanced, because the vagina naturally should be slightly acidic, that isn't going to pull water out. And in general, I would recommend two brands. One is called Silk with a Y, and the other is called Yes. So good lube, and the double glide effect is when you use an oil-based lubricant inside the vagina and a water-based lubricant on the penis or sex oil finger. And because water and oil don't mix, they go over each other, and it feels more natural. Though, just to say, if you need to use condoms, you can't use condoms and an oil-based lube. So that would be my step one. Step two would be a vaginal moisturizer, so something that is longer lasting, because lubricant only lasts whilst you're having sex. And then step three would be vaginal estrogen. And for some women, it's still not enough, and then you would use HRT in combination with vaginal estrogen.
Okay, so general HRT that we talk about will have an effect on vaginal health.
Yes.
Okay, but there's also the localized. Philippa, what if HRT is not working? So you've got somebody symptomatic, goes on HRT and they're not seeing an improvement. They're messing around with their dosage. And what because I think a lot of people think that HRT is a cure, that, you know, that menopause is an illness and HRT is the cure. That's not the case.
No.
HRT, so if it's not working.
I think that, first of all, menopause is not an illness, but it is a long-term estrogen deficiency state. And we need to consider it to be that, and not the menopause being something that one has to get through and then you come out on the other side and everything's hunky-dory, because you, whilst your night sweats might go away, something else might come along, all those long-term issues come up. And whilst HRT is considered either to be the big bad wolf or the panacea, it isn't always. And I mean, the truth is, nothing is as black as white as that. The first thing to say is that HRT is not one size fits all. And that often what you will need is to fiddle the type of HRT, how we deliver the HRT, even within the, say, let's say we're going through the skin, using a different patch or using a different gel can make a difference. So the kind of HRT and then the dosage of HRT. So the standard dose of a particular gel called estrogel, we would start with 2 pumps. Some people need 1 pump. Some people need 4 pumps. So it can take a while to get into it. And then we have to work out, well, is what's happening here that it's not working, or are these side effects? So for example, maybe you're having side effects from the progesterone, and we can solve that by, instead of taking your progesterone orally, you could have your progesterone vaginally. Or is there something else going on here? And I think that especially this comes up a lot with regards to libido. Now, libido is so complicated and complex, because we are, as humans, complicated and complex, right? And so libido will have can be affected because of physical issues like pain, because why would you want to have sex if sex hurts? But also psychological issues, and that can be mental health issues like depression or anxiety. But it can also be things like low self-esteem from the fact that your body has changed related to the menopause. And maybe actually there are also problems with your relationship. So I can induce estrogen as much as we like, and I can add in a bit of testosterone to get that libido going. But if actually the issue is that you and your partner don't have a good relationship and you don't want to have sex because of that, it doesn't really matter what I'm doing. And so I think that when it comes to HRT, the first thing to do is, if it's not working, you go back to your doctor. And we might have to fiddle around in the same way that you might have tried 3 different pills before you got to the pill that you liked. And that there isn't one size fits all. And then I think it's important to look at external things and see what else is going on here, because we can't assume that everything is menopause, and we can't assume that everything isn't menopause. We are complicated people, and so sometimes medicine is complicated. The common complaint that I hear is, my GP doesn't know, or my GP isn't interested, or my GP says this is the only HRT that is safe or that I know about. Most GPs don't work in isolation anymore. Single-handed practices are something that is actually quite rare these days. The practice receptionist will know who has extra qualifications in women's health, who's got a particular interest or a special interest in it. If you come to my surgery and you ask me for a joint injection, I am not the lady for you. I can't do those. Bloke down the corridor can. but if you go to him about your hot flushes, he's going to send you my way. So the receptionist will know who has extra qualifications. That's the person that you want to see. And there are menopause specialist clinics, not enough of them, and they have very long waiting lists, but they do exist. If you're not happy, you need to keep going back.
And I think that's, you know, that's a really good point, that sort of, you know, as you say, GP practices have changed so much over the years, that there is generally somebody, might not be a menopause specialist, but there'll be somebody who has a specialism in women's health and to seek those out.
And then I think the other thing is, what can you do for yourself? Because medicine is always only one part of any equation. So what is it that you can do to take control? And that can be related to the food that you put in your mouth, the amount of times that you move your body, and how you look after your mental health. And all of those things will really make a difference. And there is evidence for them as well. And that's an aside from whether or not you go down the complementary route. And note that I say complementary, not alternative, because alternative implies one or the other. And complementary implies that they work together. If you are taking a herb, you still need to tell me as your doctor, because if herbs work, it's because there's something in them. In the same way that aspirin comes from a plant or digoxin comes from foxgloves. You know, we got lots of our medicines from plants initially. If there's something in it that's working, it also means it has the potential to interact with something else or cause a problem later on. So I think it's really important that you tell people. People will talk about things like sage, black cohosh, various herbs, red clover. The evidence for them isn't particularly great. Some people say, especially if they have milder symptoms, that they are effective. My advice would be don't try them all at once, because then you're not going to know what's working. Mm. But as long as your pharmacist or doctor says that they're not going to interact with anything else, then they are very unlikely to cause harm. The final thing that is often spoken about at the moment is about phytoestrogens in your diet. And those are natural plant-based sources of estrogen, things like tofu, soy, cucumbers, mushrooms. And one of the reasons why we potentially began to look at that is because it seems to be that in areas of the world where lots of those types of foodstuffs are eaten, like in Asia, that women have less symptoms. That's really difficult, because why they may have fewer symptoms may have lots and lots of different reasons, including cultural ones. So that already is very complicated. What isn't known about phytoestrogens at the moment, and more research needs to be done, is can you just start to eating lots of them when you're 40? How much of them do you need to eat, and how long do you need to have been eating them for? Do you need to have been eating them your whole life? We don't know. But these foods are foods which are healthy. They're not going to do you harm, so it's not going to do any harm for you to try. But there are lots of diet and lifestyle and exercise tips that will make a difference to menopause.
If you're eating a diet rich in phytoestrogens and isoflavones that kind of mimic estrogen in your body, and you're taking HRT, can you end up with too much estrogen?
So too much estrogen is only really a problem if you don't have progesterone to counterbalance it. So estrogen is what makes the grass grow in your uterus, the lining of the uterus grow and flourish. It's fertilizer. Progesterone comes along and mows the lawn. And you need that, because actually, if you don't have that, then the lining of the womb can become thicker and thicker and thicker. And then that's an increased risk for developing abnormal cells within that and womb cancer. So as long as you have progesterone coming along to mow that lawn, then it should be okay. And that's why if you have a womb and you haven't had a hysterectomy, then when you have HRT, you will always be given progesterone as well as estrogen.
Does that mean you will carry on, if you're on HRT long term, so you're still in your 70s and all your checks are good and your doctor suggests you carry on taking it, do you still carry on taking the progesterone, which triggers that monthly bleed? Will you still be having
a bleed? There are two kinds of HRT when we talk about how you take it. One is called sequential HRT and one is called continuous combined HRT. So as we know, we're talking about the HRT being complicated. It's not just about which estrogen and progesterone and how we give it, but it's also how often we give it. If you have sequential HRT, you take the estrogen every day and the progesterone for part of the month, and then you have a bleed. If you take continuous combined HRT, you have estrogen every day, and you have a lower dose of progesterone every single day. And which one we start depends where you are in your menopause transition. So if you have periods, and I try and give you continuous combined HRT, you're going to bleed all over the place. So we give you sequential HRT, so you have a monthly period. If you come and your periods have stopped, then we're going to give you CCT, continuous combined, so that you don't bleed. And then there's that grey area in the middle where we say, well, okay, you started at 45. How old are you when you should try the other, and swap you over so that you don't have to be bleeding when you're 60 and 70. And there isn't really a hard and a fast rule. Some people will say within 2 years of HRT, some people will say within five. Generally, it's that point when we think that your ovaries will have stopped working entirely. Because in the perimenopause, 1 month you might ovulate, 1 month you might not, 3 months you might not, then you might for 3 months, and it's all a little bit erratic. So generally, by the time you're 55, everything will have stopped and you could switch, but often we will switch before that. So by the time you're 60, 70, if you're still on HRT, you shouldn't be having a bleed. And that's really important to say, because any bleeding after the menopause, after 1 year, after your last period, is considered to be postmenopausal bleeding. And that always needs to be investigated, because we are looking for things like womb cancer. So even if you're on continuous combined HRT and you haven't bled in 15 years and suddenly you have a bleed, you don't assume that that's the HRT. You need to go and get that checked out.
Right. Okay. Good point. Really good point. Because do we stop getting smears at a certain age, Philippa?
Yes, 65. So smears start at 25 every 3 years until 49. And then between 50 and 64, so up to your 65th birthday, it's every 5 years. And then you'd only have them if there was a problem in the years before that. But so lots of people think, well, you know, I'm after the menopause, I don't need to have a smear. You still do.
Yeah, good point. I've got my letter on my pin board.
I know.
And I use lockdown as an excuse. I know.
And
I
actually, need to... for women after menopause, people, they often say that it can be a little bit more uncomfortable, and that's because of the vaginal dryness. Mm. And so whilst we use a little bit of lubricant to take the test, you can't use lots because it interferes with the sampling. So if you know that you have dryness, if you know that it's uncomfortable, then actually your GP will either recommend a vaginal moisturizer to use for a few weeks before, or even just to use vaginal estrogen for 2 weeks before, even if you say, I don't need it the rest of the time, but I need something for my smear. That's how important your smear is, that we will give you treatment so that you can have it.
Wow. Okay. To make sure that because they can be quite painful. Let's not talk about smears, because I'm crossing my legs as we speak.
They can be uncomfortable, but they shouldn't be painful. And remember, they are all over in a few minutes.
I know. I last time I had a smear, actually, I got a bit hyperventilated because I was breathing. I was really concentrating on my breath.
Yeah.
And then the nurse said to me, you need to calm down, because I
was like, so I recommend two things. The first is to think about putting your bottom down into the bed. Because your instinct is to sort of tense up, and that lifts your bottom up. And if you're squeezing against the speculum, that hurts more. So just think about putting your bottom down. And then you have to count the breathing. That's what stops you hyperventilating. So a slow count of four in, a slow count of four out. So not 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, but a slow count, and that will help you sort of control it.
And it kind of started that way. And then it got faster and faster. I mean, she was lovely. And it was, you know, it was a little bit of pain. She was amazing. I have to say, she was fantastic. And she's since left the practice. So, yeah, that's another excuse. I need to have a smear. Philippa, the different types of HRT, bioidentical and body identical. So we've got these. Again, this is another topic of discussion. So we've got the body identical, which is prescribed on the NHS, and we've got bioidentical, which is prescribed at private clinics. Mm-hmm. The difference between the two.
Mm. So this is one of the most controversial areas around HRT currently. And I think that whilst whether or not to give HRT in the first place might have been controversial 20 years ago, the evidence now is much clearer. But with the bioidentical versus body identical debate, it is the debate of the moment. So the first thing that people say is that bioidentical is the same chemical structure as what is given as what you have naturally in the body. So is mine. Body identical HRT is exactly the same chemical structure as what's in the body. Bioidentical HRT is often compounded, which means that the estrogen and progesterone are made up according to your blood test results, even though we know blood test results are not particularly useful around the time of menopause. And both the estrogen and progesterone is often given through the skin in a cream. In a nutshell, there isn't the evidence base behind it, and there isn't the safety data behind it. And I have patients that were told that they could, because it's bioidentical, they could have estrogen alone, who then develop womb cancer. I have patients who spend an absolute fortune on tests and on treatment and are better, and on tests and on treatment who aren't better. As a doctor, I can only do one, what is evidence-based, and two, what is safe. And there is not the research and the safety data around bioidentical HRT. And it is touted as the more natural option. If it is natural and it works, it's because it's active. And automatically, that means that it has the same risks. And that's why I would recommend that you went for a body identical form of HRT, where we know what those risks are and how to decrease them.
Wow. In a nutshell, that clears that up. Brilliant. And as you said, I mean, there is a big cost linked to bioidentical. And I think a lot of women buy into that because they hear that it's, you know, it's safer, there's less risks, it's more natural. And actually, when you look at the stats that you cited at the beginning of the conversation about the low risk of taking the NHS version of body identical, it's kind of, yeah, you need to research.
And I think also that women around this time are vulnerable, and they don't feel great. And that when you're vulnerable, people need to be more careful. And I don't necessarily just mean the women themselves. I mean, the industry needs to also be responsible and say, you know, that we need to do sort of what's ethically right. And what's ethically right is what is safe.
Right. But there's no evidence to say that bioidentical isn't safe, but it just carries as much risk as body identical because it's got an active ingredient.
So more research needs to be done. But if you were to extrapolate the data that there is about HRT, one would have to extrapolate that to bioidentical HRT as well. Which would imply that the estrogen has a risk when it is unopposed to progesterone. And so it sort of doesn't make scientific sense to say, well, just because it's made up into a cream that is compounded together, that makes it safe. Well, you need to prove to me that it's safe.
Right. And when we talk about, so utogestin is the progesterone part of HRT,
Uterogestan is the body identical progesterone part of HRT. There are other progesterones as well.
And when we talk about that body identical, and it's made, so you say it's the same chemical structures found in the body. Right. There are obviously all of these medications are made in a lab. There's no natural derivatives in them anymore, is there? It's all the chemicals. They may be made from yams. Is it actual yams, or is it a chemical made yam? Are there any natural ingredients in them?
They say, oh, it's safer because it's made from yams, and so is ours initially.
Yeah.
Do you know, I don't exactly know the extraction process to know how they do it, bearing in mind that the first HRT was Premarin, which is pre for pregnant, mar for mare, in for urine. Premarin, it came from pregnant horse urine, and they extracted it from there. So it's possible that it's still extracted from a yam. I don't know exactly how they make it, but it is based on the same compound. And the reason why we sort of say that it's important for it to have the same chemical structure is that means it's going to act most like estrogen and progesterone in the body, because the body is used to receiving it in a certain way, because that's how it forms naturally. So you want to be as close as you can, and you're less likely to get side effects that way. And again, that's something that is true of the pill, that the first generation pills had many more side effects than the third generation pills that we're now on, as we are better able to hone that chemical formula.
Is Premarin still on the market? Is it still prescribed?
Don't think so. But don't think so, but that doesn't mean that it isn't. It's not something that I prescribe.
No, it might be in the back of a drawer somewhere. And Philippa, what if for many reasons you can't take HRT? Obviously, we talk about localized vaginal estrogen that's much safer, even if you are at risk. There are some, which I was very surprised to read, there are some prescribable alternatives to HRT.
Yeah. So the first thing to say is, no matter what your reason is for thinking that you can't have HRT, do talk to your doctor about it, because it might be right, it might not be. So you can have HRT if you've had migraines. You can have HRT if your mum had breast cancer, if your sister had breast cancer. And for some women who've had breast cancer themselves, their oncologists agree that for them, if they're really, truly affected by their symptoms, that the benefits might still outweigh that risk. That's rarer, but it does happen. But there are lots of alternatives for women who can't have HRT or who don't want to have HRT. And the first of them is a group of antidepressant medicines of various kinds, the commonest being an SSRI. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that you're depressed. Even if depression is a sign of your is one of your symptoms related to the menopause, we use medicines all the time for things that they weren't originally made for. And what happened when people were put on SSRIs for depression, they noted that they got less hot flushes. And so then you say, oh, okay, that's interesting in that study. And then you go and do more studies and see, does it work whether or not you're depressed? And there is evidence that particularly for what we call those vasomotor symptoms, the flushes and the night sweats, that an SSRI or another form of antidepressant can be effective. We also use anti-seizure medications. Again, doesn't mean that I think you've got epilepsy, but pregabalin or gabapentin have evidence for them. So there are different options available. And I think that my main message would be that I don't want any woman to suffer. And no matter what you think your options are or aren't, it's still worth going to have that conversation with your doctor. And what I'm asked often is, well, how do I know when I'm ready? How do I know when I need to go and see the GP? And the answer is when you can't manage anymore. And that point will be different for every single woman. And it will be a different age and it will be a different symptom. But when you're thinking, I just can't, that's the time to go.
That's really lovely advice, because I think a lot of women do get to that point, don't they, where it's just all too much, that sandwich generation of everything that's going on in their life. And you sort of say at the beginning of the book that, you know, you get a lot of women, am I there yet? You know, one of the most common questions asked about the perimenopause is, does X symptom mean that I am in menopause? The first signs of perimenopause.
So it will be different for everybody, but actually one of the first signs women often report is that their periods get a little bit more frequent as opposed to further apart, or they get heavier. But for everybody it will be different. And if you imagine, well, not imagine, if you remember that puberty took you a period of years and your period started one day, but you know, breast development took some time and hair development took some time and you were grumpy for a period of time and you were tired for a period of time, right? And that process takes years. Well, so does this. And so you can have symptoms 4 years before that final period. Now, the average age in the UK for women to go through the menopause is 50-51, which means that most women will have symptoms from their 40s. But there is a proportion of women who will go through the menopause earlier. Even premature menopause, it's rare, but it can happen even in your teens. And so if you're going to go through your menopause at 40 as opposed to 50, then you're going to get symptoms in your 30s. So it really depends on what's going on. I would say that if you are, well, the guidance is that if you're over the age of 45 and you've got perimenopausal symptoms, we don't even need to give blood tests. That's what the NICE guidance says. We can just treat you. If you're under the age of 40, then we definitely need to have a set of blood tests, because there are lots of other causes why your periods might vanish or become very irregular, such as problems with your thyroid hormone or with another hormone called prolactin or various other things. So we would want to know what was going on. Which just reminds me that if you have a premature menopause, there, and let's say you're in your 30s or the 20s or in your 40s, there are no risks associated with HRT until the age of 50. And that is because you are simply replacing the hormones which would ordinarily be expected to be there. And if you go through the menopause in your 30s, you've got an extra 20 years without estrogen, which means that your risks of things like osteoporosis are much greater. So actually, everybody who goes through a premature menopause would be strongly advised to have HRT.
Wow. Philippa, I mean, that really is
a whistle-stop tour.
A whistle-stop tour of a lot of questions that, you know, I get asked and I come across. Thank you so much for divulging all that knowledge to us. I mean, and I know so women either have a resistance to going to their GP, to sort of acceptance that this is what's happening, or they don't have a GP that's as well educated as you on this subject. So thank you so much on behalf of women everywhere for answering those questions. And before we wrap up today, I always ask my guests if they can recommend a book that has educated them, inspired them, or just meant something to them. And I know that you have a recommendation for us that is reflects back to a period of your time when you yourself had cancer.
Yeah. So I had two books, because books are so important that choosing one is nigh impossible. The first is Everything That Makes Us Human, which is a book that's written by a pediatric neurosurgeon. I mean, can you imagine to have the brain of a baby in your hands? Oh. And it's a book that's about what it means to be human, and it's a book about love. But my second book is not even a book with very many words, and it is The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. And a friend of mine sent it to me when I was in intensive care after one of the surgeries that I had for my own bowel cancer, and I was very unwell. To the extent that I could not read, not that I couldn't see, I could not focus and pay attention. And it was a book where I could just open it and see a picture and essentially remember that somebody loved me. And I think that's hugely important. When it comes to the menopause, I would just like to add one little anecdote, which is not in my book. And I regret not putting it in. And it was in the beginning when I was researching which other animals went through the menopause. Because it's us and the pilot whales when it comes to mammals. The elephants don't do it. No one else does it, right? Us and the pilot whales. But there are loads of insects that do it. Not that insects bleed, but they have a post sort of reproductive phase. And I came across this story of a kind of locust, cricket, grasshoppery thing somewhere in Asia. And they have females that have a post reproductive phase. And when the colony is under attack, they send out this group of females, the post-reproductive females or the post-menopausal females, to defend the colony. And I think that 50 years ago, in our patriarchal society, we would have said, that's right, you send out those women because they have no value anymore. And now I think actually that colony of whatever kind of grasshopper they are sending out the women with wisdom, who have gone through their childbearing years, whether or not they have children, but they have managed their periods and they have developed wisdom for however many years this insect lives for. And that's why they're sending them to defend the colony, because menopausal women have this power and this knowledge, and that's how we should view that phase in our lives.
Oh, to a powerful, wonderful, wise guest. Thank you, Philippa. What a lovely note to end on. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. And thank you to Vicky Bristow Communications for producing this series. You can find out more about me and my work at www.themerrymenopause.com or follow me on Instagram at @themerrymenopause. If you like what you hear, please leave a review and subscribe. It will really help other people to find me.